This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
So, my friend was describing Lent to me, and you almost certainly know more about this than me, but because I know almost nothing, but practice is one of giving up something for the course of 40 days to be this kind of spiritual practice and reminder. And often people give up stuff like
spinach
or booze or meat or something. But he made a more radical gesture, and what he did is relevant to what we're talking about tonight, anger. He gave up being right. Because he was noticing that as he was walking through the airport, and he was seeing on television screens a particular political figure commentator that he does not agree with, and he had a meltdown in LAX, and it occurred to him, he's not a meditator, but it occurred to him that the source of that suffering was his insistence that he is right and Rush Limbaugh is not. And so in our lives and in our meditation practice, we can consider what it would be like to give up on being right. And it doesn't mean that we're left as this kind of completely passive being that can't make the choice whether to stop or go at a green light, right? But the investment in the kind of emotional charge that happens when our ideas of ourself get bound up with certain claims about being right, that the opinions that we develop in meditation and out of meditation kind of frees us. There's no space in a very firm conclusion about who we are. And so, as we practice meditation, we're really continually stepping off of the ground of our conclusions. That as we pay attention, there are kind of like quiet storylines that creep up, and they go under the radar of awareness. And what happens is we just buy them totally. And meditative practice is beginning to hear more and more clearly those storylines and know them as story. And in fact, the very sense of being very sense of self, our sense of self, is story. Do you know how when you're meditating, it feels like you're standing from a certain perspective and looking out? You have a sense of, I'm standing here and I'm looking out and meditating from here. And our practice is actually to see that that very sense of being separate from life, looking out, is story. That it feels like the place from which we're looking is this neutral point of view, but it's actually quiet story that we haven't noticed. And so in practice, our heart is oriented towards listening more deeply to hearing all these different little storylines that create a sense of separation from life. Because that ground that we stand on that makes us feel separate from life is just more phenomena arising and passing. It doesn't feel that way because we don't see it closely. But that sense of where we stand is just more of the, you know, touch, sight, sound, hearing, seeing, thinking. It's just more of that. Even though it feels like the place that from which we look out. And so in this way, meditation is coming to a deeper appreciation of a groundlessness. Stepping off that ground again and again. Does this make sense? I say it not because I think it'll make total sense, but it's something to experiment with and see how that is. And something that maybe doesn't feel so relevant right now, but it's something to consider, because we live trust, like really not questioning the basic perspective from which we're looking. And that's our meditative attention needs to be directed to that too. Because ultimately that is very bound up in the process of anger, of suffering generally, anger specifically. Yeah, Carol.
I have a friend who often, in a pejorative way, will quote unquote bust me and say, "You're just in your story." And I always, it doesn't seem to help me very much when she says that. I just don't want to be around her.
How did it sound when I just told you that? Yeah. Yeah. Well, what she was likely referring to was one layer of story. You know, it's like we're familiar with the top layer of story, just like we're familiar with the top mask that we wear. You know, the sort of our performance of some persona. And psychotherapy works with that top layer. I, you know, I, it's maybe unfair. I'm a therapist. It works primarily with the top layer of story, the first and second mask. But in Buddhism, it's masks all the way down. It's stories all the way down to nothing. And we can begin to relinquish the more obvious stories, and then we can begin to listen to the more subtle stories, the story that just says, I'm Matthew. But that's story two. And so what I'm pointing to here is the kind of all the different stories that we have running at the same time, and beginning to listen and listen. And sometimes all we're going to be able to hear is the top story that's strategizing about dinner or reflecting back on the day. And we can listen to that with a loving heart. And then we can listen to the other stories.
On your talk, you were saying, you know, but uncovering the masks until there's nothing of the story. How do you do that? Okay. If you can speak more about, like, you know, going like from the second mask to the third to the fourth, or constantly removing masks.
I think we listen more and more deeply to what's arising in body and mind, because our attention gets stuck and fixated at one level, and we take all the other levels of story for granted as unquestioned. But there are more subtle registers of thinking that's going on in terms of our imagery and our internal dialogue, in terms of our emotion, the emotion in our body, and we're learning to listen more and more deeply to that. And so it's like a psychotherapist who's very skilled at listening, and we're listening in that same way to ourselves. And listening to all the layers, and we just become more and more familiar with the assumptions that have gone unquestioned in our lives, that have shaped how we've lived. And it may be very subtle rumblings in the mind, but that's what we're learning to listen to. So the sense that there's a real me back there that I need to uncover is challenged a little bit by this. That I think we can live from some sense of authenticity and aliveness and connected to our emotional world, but we never stop relinquishing the masks. So just listen, and I say these things because I want people to have a kind of heads up for these themes in Dharma practice, but it's also not a rush at all. And I certainly don't understand, don't know where this investigation ends by any stretch. So I'm just sharing, not to say that this is where all of our effort has to go, but just to be aware that this is a theme in Dharma practice. Yeah.
The story analogy was really working for me in the first part of this sit, because I've always considered myself kind of an unreliable narrator in my own life. So when it's like, you know, when I would feel or see these images, I'd start to tell the stories of the day or the plans. Or, you know, I was recognizing them as stories, and it was easy to sort of turn the page, or just sort of, I had this image of a page fluttering away. And I was feeling just peaceful and pleasant and not attaching. And then all of a sudden, something was coming up in my body. And I was holding on for dear life at one point there, but, you know, trying not to cough, and then I was, you know, gonna disturb the whole, you know, beautiful karmic balance of the room. And finally, there was an eruption. I, you know, my eyes started to water, and I was really like, I was about to have a breakdown. And I thought, like, I'd have to run out of here. I never opened my eyes during one of these sits until this moment, you know. And it was really uncomfortable. And I don't, you know, it was a physical sensation, manifestation. I don't know what it was. But then, and I was just going through so much. I'm just reporting here. Like, it was like I was feeling like an athlete in battle with, or it was like I was doing battle with something. And I had to, you know, somehow make it through this discomfort. And I, you know, that wasn't working for me. And somehow, I don't know, I think really when you started to speak again about the heart being at ease, something penetrated and I softened a little bit. And that's how, that's how I got through it. Barely, but I was slowly getting, back on track. That was a real rupture for me, and I don't know what to do during those times.
Yeah,
help is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Get used to them is one piece of advice. That's not what you wanted to hear, but. That
I won't be so hard on myself.
Yeah. That arising is totally, totally natural. And I don't know exactly what you're describing, but there will be times in our meditation practice where there is 99% of our being is saying, run. And we keep a thread to the Dharma, and there's a little, it's just bearable. Yeah. And in those states, it can be helpful to see how it's actually okay in that moment, but it's our imagining that this is going to continue that is really makes it unbearable. That nothing's going to change. And so we don't need to count on impermanence changing something, but we can just stay there, and as one teacher says, just ask the question, like, is this bearable right now? Because envisioning the next, 20 minutes of the meditation in that state will amp up the level of overwhelm past the threshold. And so, see if you can just stay, notice the emotional reactivity to the state, the sense of urgency. Actually, you can actually taste the urgency. And this is a very obvious example because it was incredibly unpleasant. But that sense of urgency is with us all the time, really. That any, even subtle levels of unhappiness are met with a sense of urgency. I must do something. We don't notice that always, but just scratching my face is, if I do it unconsciously, is preceded by something in my body and mind that says, like, there's a big deal going on the face. Like, I don't recognize it as that unless I'm paying attention. But
yeah, I had a few of those.
Yeah, yeah. So begin to get a flavor of what the urgency is. And see if you can open the heart to that. And you know what? It's fine to get up sometimes. Yeah, Samantha?
I've had similar sensations in group sittings recently, and especially here. And, I, for myself, just want to say with you, with all your presence and peacefulness, said groundlessness, you know, I thought I'm not going to make it through meditation. And I think I read, I think Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation, he says, no parachute, no ground. But from where I am sitting, you know, that's not my experience. My experience is extreme fear.
Is extreme fear, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I think when Joseph was describing that, I think the first realization is there's no parachute. And then only later is there the realization of no ground. But the no parachute phase, still ground? You see what I mean? Parachute gone, ground still there, panic. Can you describe a little what the nature of the panic?
Well, it's very close to what this gentleman was describing. It's I started on a 10-day retreat about day 4 or 5, and it was a sense that I should leave. And then specifically, and it was the day they were discussing arising, falling, passing away. Mm. And then it became very strong in individual sittings that there was something terrible. And I needed to flee the room immediately. And how would I get up? And how would I make my way out of the room around the other meditators and disturb peace? And it was just I felt I would die. I mean, it felt like a panic attack.
Yeah.
And then only by remembering equanimity that I, you know, because it didn't feel bearable.
Yeah.
You say, does it feel bearable in the second? And the answer was really no. But I just stay with breath and just try various things.
Yeah. Well, I don't think the answer is always to just stay with it and keep opening. Sometimes, and most of the time, I do. When people ask questions about difficult experience, my tendency is to stay, to say, the heart can hold that too. As Jack Kornfield said, be the first to die of fear on the meditation cushion, right? That's one perspective. Not always skillful. But if you do want to play with that edge, you can begin, and this is helpful, is to, as my teacher Shinzen says, keep the various strands of experience in awareness, because it's their tangle that creates the sense of panic. And the strands of experience in those cases are probably physical pain, emotional pain, panicky feeling, a storyline that's saying, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me and I'm not going to be able to make it, which is a story. You know, images of the body, you know, running out, what, you know, or the body, if there's a lot of physical pain of, you know, literally the knee on fire is the image. And if we can keep those components of our experience in awareness, the sense of overwhelm is relieved. And the overwhelm is actually a product of some level of unconsciousness, of ping-ponging from horrible feeling in the chest to pain in the body to panic stories to images, right? It's pure suffering. And but those are all, that experience is really arising because different aspects of different channels of data, we could say, are getting tangled. We're not clear on them. Does that make sense? So, yeah, and you can practice any time. It doesn't have to be full-blown anxiety. But to listen to the thoughts, to see the images, to feel the emotional charge in the body, see if you can keep that in awareness with some allowing, some spirit of allowing. Does it sound okay?
Yeah, thank you.
Sure. Maybe one more. Yeah.
When you talk about a groundlessness, you said, like, when we're meditating, usually we're coming from a spot where there's still a subtle storyline.
Yeah.
And I noticed with myself that there's sort of a need to sort of know, and there's like a storyline going on because there's a need to really know that I'm figuring it out, and but in most cases, even that, like what I conclude from that, sort of gets me in trouble too.
Yeah, so, that's great.
Can you talk about the contrast of groundlessness and the storyline? Well, like, groundlessness is like, it's really kind of scary, or you don't really know, there's no ground, so I don't know what's going to happen. But it seems that if you are like coming from groundlessness, things sort of turn out better.
Yeah, that is a weird thing. That, and my teacher has said, it's kind of, in some ways, a mystery why this is, but that a kind of uncontrived love is the face of groundlessness. But what you're doing is good. What you noticed, what you reported of that next level of story, which is Angelo, the meditator, figuring things out, improving his life, doing good, you know, whatever it is, right? We all have the character of me, the meditator, who's making progress or screwing up, right? And that storyline is often going, but totally unquestioned. And you're starting to hear. Because if that's unquestioned, we're still alienated from our life. We're still standing on that ground. And our practice is exactly what you're saying, to hear that too. Because the need to make progress and stay oriented and know that I'm having insights is just more story. You know, it's irresistible. I mean, I know from my mind that I'll take one breath, breathe out, one more, breathe out, and then I'm like, what I just learned? Am I freer than two breaths ago? Do I know the Dharma more deeply now? And it will go on like that continuously. I want the goods, you know, it's like pay me. But meditation, we come as beggars at the door of experience. And we just take what we get. The insights will come. They will not come because we are smart or something. You know, they just come from awareness. We will learn through awareness. But we have to relinquish the knowledge can be the enemy of insight in that way. And so we have to let go of the need to understand, to make sense, to be oriented all the time, so that some other capacity can take root. This is the second week talking about anger. How many people were here last week? Okay. So just to review briefly, In Buddhism, anger is appreciated as a very critical issue for our lives. And it doesn't take much looking around, looking at the newspapers, to see the profoundly destructive effects of anger and the ways in which it can harden into hatred. And really the worst episodes, the most tragic parts of human history revolve around hatred. And so we talked about the practice of beginning to take care, to take deep care of our own anger for ourselves, but also as a way of providing safety for our families and communities. That the longing that other people have to feel safe in our presence should be honored. But to cultivate really non-violence is effortful. That it's not just about being nice, to really be able to meet our own anger with tenderness, to be able to digest it in ways where it doesn't spill out is a demanding practice and very important. And so we can frame this kind of work as something that we offer to really everyone around us to begin to create a deeper sense of safety. And this is going to take an inward move. We're going to have to begin to know the seeds of anger within us, even though anger always points us out, right? I mean, anger is always pointing us out towards the cause, right? And our practice is to point the attention back inwards. That, of course, there may be situations that we need to deal with. And every once in a while, anger may be a sign, okay, something has to be done. But in order to act most skillfully, we need to come into a deep, tender relationship with our own anger. To take full responsibility. Not that it has arisen, but that it is here. So this is not a path of suppression, and we're not bad people that anger arises. Right? This is really critical. Because if we start to get in a battle with the anger, if we start to think that that's an unbecoming emotion, right? This is actually just more conflict. And so, can we, as Thich Nhat Hanh asks, come into the relationship with our own anger as a compassionate mother relates to her child, to a child having a tantrum? The Buddha uses some strong language here. What is the one thing, Buddha, whose killing you approve? It doesn't use that language much. What's the one thing whose killing you approve? The killing of anger with its poisoned root and honeyed tip. This is the killing the noble ones praise. For having slain that, one does not sorrow. And so, the Buddha is alluding here to the honeyed tip and poisoned root, and that sense of empowerment and authority and self-righteousness in anger is that honey. But we're actually, how many people can raise their hand and say, it was really good that I got furious and hated that person, right? Like, anger is almost never born of wisdom. And so, just one sec. And so, what we can begin with is the perspective, and I begin with this, I know when I'm angry, I have a deep confidence that I'm missing something. That I'm not seeing fully. because I've had enough experiences of looking more deeply into a situation that makes me angry, and never have I become more angry by seeing more deeply. As I see more deeply into what is happening in myself, in another, always there is a softening, more compassion.
I was just going to comment your, what you said earlier about kind of tangled threads.
Yeah.
I think it feels really applicable to anger as I'm thinking about what you're saying. Somehow the other, many other feelings that we feel, that I feel more easily, I can understand as universal part of human experience, but there's something about anger that feels more like personal, like my personal story, angry because X, Y, and Z. And and I'm just thinking that kind of untangling those pieces and finding the different stories going on just feels really applicable to that.
Yeah.
Feeling
yeah.
like when it feels that personal, it's like, okay, so what are these different things that are going on in my story?
Yeah.
They're usually not related to what's happening right there in that moment.
Right, right. And I think what you're pointing to is that anger depends on a certain ego identification that we have. That we're most sensitive, we're most prone to anger when we're defending the particular ideas we have about who we are. You know, and it's like these soft spots in us, these sensitive spots that need our attention. So I'll maybe sketch this out. There are a few ways of thinking about dealing with anger. And some of these strategies have to do with detecting it as it's arising, as it kind of, you know how like a fire kindles? And it's you start like making a campfire with little twigs or something, and then it gets a bit bigger. Right, and then you can put the bigger logs on, and then you've got a fire, right? Anger starts in that way, actually. And it's really hard to deal with once the fire is totally, you know, going on. But there may be times when we can actually listen deeply to ourselves to short-circuit it. And it's tricky because even one line in our head can just start it up, right? It's just like, yeah, but she, right? Right? It's just that. And if that goes without being heard, unquestioned, not heard in awareness, fire, right? But sometimes we can pay attention when the mindfulness is steady, we can pay attention to that kindling process. The mind starts to go, the body starts to get tighter and tighter, right? And part of what we're doing in training our minds in meditation is to be more sensitive to intense emotion as it's arising in ordinary life. That's part of what we're doing in steadying our attention, in learning to listen more deeply to ourselves. And so you may be able to catch this, and it may have a very similar the storyline is probably very similar. You've heard it before, right? It's like our storylines of anger, they're familiar, right? So can we hear them as anger? Can we hear them as anger? Now, when anger has fully arisen, and we are really in the throes of it, to work with it is a renunciation. It's one of the kind of celebrated values of the Buddha, renunciation. And I don't know how that word sounds to you, but the normal thought is that it's giving up something that's good because we should. Right? I mean, isn't that kind of, that's how it sounds to me. Like, okay, I won't eat a Snickers bar. You know, it's like that, right? One teacher's reframed it, that the idea of giving up things that actually make you happy is insane. Like, giving up what makes you genuinely happy? Worst idea ever. But renunciation is not that. We're giving up the false promises of happiness. And anger is a false promise of happiness. That if we follow its logic and act it out, that will be better. And so the renunciation, Shantideva, I think, says, who wrote something on patience in dealing with anger, just if you feel totally compelled to act out, to say something, to do something, just sit there like a log. Because we're not going to be able to deal effectively with our situation. And so Thich Nhat Hanh says to take some deep breaths. He actually recommends walking meditation when we're really angry, to just be conscious of the feet moving, the sensations of the feet on the ground. And Thich Nhat Hanh, he's really very, his book on anger is very helpful. It's titled Anger. I recommend it. And he says that it's really important that we not pretend we're not angry. This is my habit. Like, if I'm angry at somebody, I'm just kind of, that's cool. And the reason for me, and maybe for you, is that to acknowledge anger is actually very deeply vulnerable. To act it out is not vulnerable. To acknowledge it is very vulnerable. To say, I'm angry with you, in a way that's not accusatory, that just is honest about what's happening. This is very vulnerable, because it feels like I'm handing my heart, and it's kind of like, please be nice, you know, very vulnerable. And in relationships where anger is most likely to arise amongst the people we love most, people we depend on most, Thich Nhat Hanh says if there is a sufficient understanding that and willingness to work skillfully with anger together, he actually recommends talking to to the person after one settled down a bit with some practice. And he has these three steps, three things to say that I find so moving. And so you would come to the person you're angry with, and obviously this is not appropriate for many situations, but for many it is. And you would say, I'm angry, I suffer. Just acknowledging, I'm angry, I suffer. I'm doing my best. And I need your help. Doing my best, and I need your help. And that every time I say that, it moves me so deeply, because those phrases are so perfectly designed to cut through the arrogant, independent, non-vulnerable state that anger puts us in. It just cuts right through all of that. I'm angry, I suffer, I'm doing my best, I need your help. And so, even if you don't say those things, even if that's not totally appropriate, it can be helpful to reflect on in this way. And from this perspective in Thich Nhat Hanh's way of working, we're caring for our anger. We're not suppressing, and we're not indulging. We're caring for it. So the practice is about short-circuiting anger as it's arising, about working with it. And I don't have a lot of time, but working with it often in the body once it has arisen, the intensity in the body of just staying wordlessly with the feeling in the body, not in getting involved in the stories that justify the anger, staying directly with the sensations in the body, which are excruciating. Anger is excruciatingly painful. And that's why it gets us to act out in such a robotic way most of the time. And then we're also developing habits that militate against the arising of anger in the first place. Now, don't misunderstand, as I said, that anger arises is okay. But we're actually also developing these long-term habits of mind that work against anger arising in the first place. And these understandings, and Enrique mentioned last week about the practice of forgiveness, of beginning to diffuse some of the old resentments that can function like bombs inside, of working through our past in a way that drains it of its explosive charge, that begins to see our past in ways that is totally clear-eyed, but sees deeply enough that resentment begins to fade, that sees how suffering met in unconsciousness always leads to more suffering? That that's just the logic of things? And it helps us understand how others have hurt us? That we're also nourishing the antidote to ill will, to anger, which is metta, or loving kindness. That the two can't exist in the same moment, right? That anger cuts us off so deeply from our hearts that we can act in really destructive ways. But if we're watering the seeds of kindness, there's less room for anger to arise. And we're also developing this insight that we were talking about earlier and in the meditation of selflessness, of seeing how there are kind of pressure points in our ego that can really trigger us. And as we develop a deeper sense of who we're not, there's less territory to protect. There are fewer ideas that we cherish about ourselves, and we're less defensive. And the flip side of selflessness is otherlessness. That in anger, we always want to pin it on someone. And not just someone, we want to pin it on their soul. Because it is inherently corrupted and disgusting. But the insight into selflessness helps us see that there is not that person to pin it on in that way. That we want, anger wants that desperately, to pin it on them. And we begin to see more clearly. And that's why this the reflection on seeing the suffering of another and how that leads to their behavior, how the conditions create their anger. How, as Shanti Deva says, how can you resent fire for giving off heat? And we develop this insight and begin to create the internal conditions for ourselves for anger not to arise with the same intensity and frequency. And this practice, this is like science fiction to me, but apparently can be developed to such a depth that anger doesn't arise anymore. That at a Thich Nhat Hanh retreat, a young boy asked Thich Nhat Hanh whether he gets angry anymore. And he said, as a young monk, yeah. But now with the years of looking deeply and nourishing the seeds of kindness, no more. And that is a function of seeing clearly. If we see clearly, anger is weakened. So we have to stop. This is a big topic, apparently. Yeah, it's really good to practice with you. Thank you for your attention. So, just taking a moment, allowing the eyes to close for a second. May our efforts to care for our own anger, may they benefit other beings. May we nourish the seeds of nonviolence within us and begin to provide deeper and deeper safety for all beings we encounter. Thank you. Thank you for your practice.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.